Iran marks National Army Day by holding military parades and displaying parts of its achievements in the defense sector. President Raisi says Iranian armed forces will target, quote, the center of the Zionist regime if it makes the slightest move against Tehran. And tensions remain high in the occupied Palestinian territories following the recent Israeli raids on the Al-Aqsa Mosque. I'm Behruz Najafi. Welcome. Iran's marking National Army Day by holding parades that put on display its latest military accomplishments. The parades involve homegrown equipment of the Army's Air Force, Ground Force, and Navy. This year, the parade in the capital, Tehran, featured the latest radar and missile systems, as well as drones, tanks, and other domestic military hardware. In a ceremony in southern Tehran, Iranian President vowed that the armed forces will target, quote, the center of the Zionist regime if it makes the slightest move against Tehran.
You should know that if you make the slightest move against the Iranian nation, the target of our armed forces will be the center of the Zionist regime. And you should certainly know that the power of our armed forces will not let you take rest.
Well, Raisi said the country's army stands ready to deal with any kind of threats posed by the enemy. Ibrahim Raisi said that the army has used the anti-Iran sanctions as an opportunity to get stronger. The president said that such readiness is a message of hope to friends of Iran and a message of deterrence to the enemies. The Israeli regime is escalating its crackdown on the West Bank as tensions run high across the occupied territories following violent attacks on Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Oguz. Israeli forces have shot two more Palestinians during their raids in the West Bank town of Al-Khalil. The regime forces have also attacked Palestinians in the Silwan neighborhood of Al-Quds. Israeli forces earlier injured some 20 more Palestinians at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Hundreds of Palestinians have been injured and detained since Friday after Israeli troops stormed the mosque and violently attacked worshippers there. Hamas resistance movement has condemned the raids, describing Al-Aqsa as its red line. Palestinians view the vicious raids and desecration of Islam's third holiest site as a major provocation. They're calling for international intervention to prevent the situation from spiraling out of control. U.S. media reports say that Saudi Arabia pushed Yemen's former president Abd Rabbu Mansour Hadi to transfer his authority to a new leadership council early this month. Citing anonymous Saudi and Yemeni officials, the Wall Street Journal says that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman had given Hadi a written decree delegating his powers to the council. According to the journal, some Saudi officials had threatened to publicize what they called evidence of Hadi's corruption unless he's handed over power to the council. The journal also said that officials have confined Hadi to his home and restricted his communications. Back in 2015, Hadi, a close ally of Riyadh, resigned and fled to Saudi Arabia amid political strife and conflict in Yemen. And that prompted the kingdom to intervene militarily to bring him back to power, but to no avail. The Turkish military has launched another incursion into Iraq, allegedly against targets of anti-Ankara Kurdish militants. Turkish Defense Ministry says that forces backed by airstrikes and artillery fire captured identified targets in northern Iraq. Belushi Akar says that militant targets, including camps and ammunition depots, were bombed in the area. He says the operation is ongoing and aimed at preventing terror attacks and ensuring Turkey's border security. Turkey regularly launches air and land operations in northern Iraq against alleged militant targets. Baghdad has denounced the military moves as a violation of its sovereignty. Moving on, just in, we have reports of Israeli forces entering Beit Hanun in the besieged Palestinian territory of the Gaza Strip. Now, to get some details regarding this Israeli incursion, let's go to our Gaza correspondent, Ashraf Shannon, and ask him what's going on there. Ashraf, over to you. What's happening?
Well, there was Israeli tanks and armored caterpillar D9 bulldozers made an incursion into the eastern part of the northern Gaza Strip, town of Beth Hanun area today. They raised the agricultural land in the area, and they fired some shots towards the farmers in the area. This is according to people who live in the area and eyewitnesses in Beth Hanun. This recent Israeli incursion into Gaza comes amid the ongoing attacks against Palestinians, especially in Al-Quds. Some people here believe that this is part of an Israeli provocation towards the Palestinian resistance, possibly trying to have them react to what's happening in Al-Quds and also in Al-Khalil, also known as Hebron. Israeli tanks and bulldozers haven't made such incursions for weeks now, although they've been doing this frequently. But today, the number of tanks and bulldozers was high, especially we're talking about eight armored bulldozers and four tanks who remained for nearly 45 minutes into the northern Gaza strip town of Beth Hanun, Beirut.
And Ashraf, it's not only tanks and armored vehicles that are threatening people in Gaza. It's also, you know, I believe that farming season has started, and you were reporting the other week that there are also herbicides and all that. So war is just going on against occupied territories, especially Gaza Strip, in different ways, in different aspects.
Well, the attacks on farmers, the attacks on fishermen has been taking place almost on a daily basis as part of the ongoing Israeli hermetic blockade on the Gaza Strip, as part of the Israeli apartheid policies of starving the people of Gaza and also depriving them from their food security. Rights groups have condemned such actions by the Israeli regime, especially like when such incursions happen, they happen in an area that Israel classifies as so-called buffer zone or no-go zone area, preventing farmers from farming in the area. And dozens of farmers in the east of the enclave have been killed or injured in recent years because they were trying to make a living or farm their lands and feed their families.
All right, thanks for that. Ashraf Shannon, our correspondent in Gaza City. Russia expresses worry about increased NATO activities in the Arctic, warning that these risk unintended incidents in the region. The Russian ambassador at large for the Arctic cooperation has been quoted as saying that NATO's activities does not contribute to the security of the region. Nikolai Kurchanov says that the alliance's activities could cause serious damage to the Arctic ecosystem. He was referring to joint NATO-Navy drills involving Finland and Sweden in March. The senior Russian diplomat also pointed to the possibility of the two Arctic nations joining the U.S.-led military alliance. But he warned that NATO expansion at the expense of traditionally non-bloc countries will not contribute to security and mutual trust. Moscow has already expressed a strong opposition to NATO's eastward expansion. Political analyst John Bosnich says that a possible NATO membership for Finland and Sweden is not to provide security for them, but to financially benefit the United States.
NATO had been designed as a defensive organization. Of course, it changed without any reference to the public in any of the countries involved. It changed to an offensive operation when they attacked the former Yugoslavia to try and rip the country apart and colonize it. Now we're talking about the effort to quickly bring in new members in the form of Sweden and Finland. And what does that actually mean? Well, to the people in the country, they're told you're being protected. But back in headquarters in Washington, what's really happening is they're counting the money. Because to join NATO, you have to have a defense budget of no less than 2% of your annual GDP. If they join NATO, every year from now on, they must contribute a minimum of 2% of $800 billion, which comes out to $16 billion a year. And that's not to be spent on their own domestic industry, defense industry, which Sweden has a very well-developed domestic industry, but they have to buy NATO-compatible weapons, which are all produced in the United States. Therefore, the United States, through this conflict in Ukraine, has made a bonanza, not just getting the access to Ukraine that they were seeking, but absorbing two new states and fast-tracking them.
The Russian Defense Ministry says its forces have a strike and ammunition plant outside the Ukrainian capital as Moscow's major offensive against Kyiv nearing its two-month mark. The ministry said that ammunition factory was targeted with, quote, high-precision air-launched missiles. The attack comes on the 54th day of the conflict, with Russian forces continuing their operation against major Ukrainian cities, including the second-largest city of Kharkiv. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says that 18 people have been killed and more than 100 wounded in the shelling in the past 4 days in Kharkiv. Meantime, two people were killed and four sustained injuries in the shelling of the eastern town of Zolote. Meantime, Ukraine says its forces in the port city of Mariupol are still fighting despite a Russian demand to surrender. The Prime Minister, Denis Shmyhal, says that Mariupol is not falling yet, adding that Ukrainian soldiers continue to control some parts of the city. Meantime, Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba said that there had not been any recent diplomatic communications between Moscow and Kyiv. He added the situation in Mariupol may be, quote, a red line in the path of negotiations. He said that Russian troops appear to have decided to raise Mariupol to the ground at any cost. The comments came hours after a Russian ultimatum for the surrender of Ukrainian forces in Mariupol expired. Despite the impacts of its strict zero COVID policy, China has reported a 4.8% economic growth in the first quarter of 2022. According to the latest data released by the National Bureau of Statistics, Chinese economy has beaten expectations with nearly 5% GDP growth compared with a year before. Tourism and manufacturing have witnessed an uptick, but the country's unyielding COVID-related restrictions in some of its financial hubs, including Shanghai and Shenzhen, disrupted supply chains domestically and internationally. Long-term lockdowns caused an increase in the unemployment rate and negatively affected retail sales. Officials warning against significant difficulties and challenges facing China's economic development. The world's second biggest economy has a full-year growth target of nearly 5.5%. Now, based on a new report, Muslim students in the United States are facing high levels of bullying, both from other peers and teachers. Nearly half of Muslim students interviewed in the state of California reported they were bullied because of the religion. That according to a survey conducted by the Council on American Islamic Relations. The report shows that more than half of the respondents felt unsafe, unwelcome, or uncomfortable at school due to their Muslim identity. It says one in three female students who wear hijab reported that their attires were tugged at, pulled, or offensively touched. The report also found approximately one-third of the students experienced or witnessed some form of cyberbullying. One disturbing findings indicated that nearly one in four respondents experienced offensive comments about Islam or Muslims from a teacher, administrator, or other adults at their schools. The United Kingdom has come under harsh criticism over its plan to send immigrants and asylum seekers to Rwanda. Now, why did the UK decide to send them to Rwanda in the first place? Condemnations are pouring in on this, with some saying that the UK government stands accused of trading people like commodities.
The UK has announced a controversial deal with Rwanda to send illegal immigrants and asylum seekers to the East African country. The British government claims this scheme, which is worth $156 million, would have stopped smugglers from sending thousands of desperate migrants on dangerous journeys across the English Channel every year. Over 28,000 migrants and refugees have crossed the English Channel in 2021. That's three times higher than the year before. In November last year, 27 people died while trying to reach the UK when their boat sank in the worst disaster to occur on the Channel. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson hailed the deal with Kigali, saying the East African country with a sketchy human rights record is one of the safest countries in the world, globally recognized for its record of welcoming and integrating migrants. Rwanda already hosts some 140,000 refugees in 6 refugee camps. However, rights groups and refugee organizations swiftly slammed what they called a cruel, inhumane, and neo-colonial plan. They also questioned both its costs to British taxpayers and its effect on migration. According to a recent poll, 60% of the British public is dissatisfied with the Johnson government's migration policy. The UN's refugee agency has also voiced opposition, saying people fleeing persecution should not be treated like commodities. The world body stated that such arrangements simply shift asylum responsibilities, evade international obligations, and are contrary to the letter and spirit of the Refugee Convention. Others have criticized Rwanda's human rights record, accusing the government of torturing, intimidating, and assassinating their political opponents, and persecuting marginalized people. Johnson said the deal will become a new international standard in handling migration, but human rights groups have warned that the plan could set a dangerous trend for other Western countries to adopt their offshore asylum schemes.
Well, Britain has a good history of trading in human beings. As you know, the whole sort of movement of Africans to North America, Britain was a leading player in shipping slaves from Africa to North America and to Caribbean islands. So Britain has a track record of trading in human beings. So one could, if you like, describe it in that manner. But I think the evil aspect of what's really happening in 2022, that may have happened 200 years ago and when later on slavery was banned. But the reality is that perhaps we are living in a new epoch of slavery at this time.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Let me put the plate of zulbia and bamiye in the middle of the table. Okay, and a cup of hot water for my grandma. My grandma breaks her fast with a cup of hot water. And here we have a plate of dates, bread, cheese, and vegetables. Hope nothing is left behind. You know, my grandma is my guest tonight for iftar, and after serving iftar meal, I'm going to visit an exhibition where people of different regions of Iran put on display the iftar food items of their own certain region. Stay with me. The blessed month of Ramadan is a lunar Hijri month, which is of high significance for Muslims. Abstaining from eating and drinking or fasting during the day is the main feature of this month. In the vast land of Iran, with its different ethnicities and local customs, different foods are made which have their own special taste, smell, form, and color. A glance at different customs and traditions of the ethnic groups of Iran show that culinary traditions during the month of Ramadan display a beautiful picture. The foods in each region of Iran are prepared based on the climate, local etiquettes, the foodstuffs, and local crops. These foods then gradually become known and recognized as the customs of these regions. I am now at the exhibition of the foods of Iranian ethnic groups. These foods are prepared during the month of Ramadan. Here there are several different pavilions. Each of them has the foods of a certain ethnic group. Let's take a look at the pavilions. The pavilion of Gilan. The traditional foods of Gilan that are cooked during the month of Ramadan mostly include asha of different types, kuku and fereni. The other type of food available in Gilan during the month of Ramadan is reshte khoshkar. Reshte khoshkar is a popular sweet in Gilan. A Gilani lady is busy making reshte khoshkar here. It smells great! Azerbaijan Pavilion. Ashadugh, Fereni, and rose flower jam are three foods which Azeris of Iran put on the table of iftar. This pavilion is filled with the aroma of rose water jam. This jam is both served as dessert as well as being used along with tea. In this pavilion, you can smell bread. Bersag bread. The people of Kurdistan bake this bread. It's made of flour, sugar, oil, egg, milk, salt, and turmeric. It's a delicious and nourishing bread for iftar. I am now at Khuzestan Pavilion. Lagemat is the popular food served in different cities of Khuzestan province, particularly in Ahvaz. Lagemat is a sweet which looks like zulbia and bamiye and is served with bitter coffee. Baking this sweet is also common among the people of other southern provinces of Iran like Bushehr and Hormozgan. There are a lot of pavilions left, but I cannot go into details in a brief radio program. There are many delicious foods to talk about in the pavilions of Hamedan, Isfahan, Kerman, Khorasan, and other provinces of Iran. Iran is the beautiful land of colors, tastes, and designs, which all create a unique picture of the rich Iranian culture. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
In as many days, at least 19 Palestinians were injured in clashes as Israeli settlers stormed Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds under the protection of Israeli military forces. Israel is not holding back its acts of provocation, especially during the holy month of Ramadan, which is why Palestinians are also acting out their frustrations against them. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the source of the problems between Israelis and Palestinians, in which Al-Quds is just one flashpoint. Let's first find out what happened. Mona Kandil is our correspondent who joins us from Occupied Ramallah. Tell us about the incident again, which has recurred at Al-Aqsa.
Well, what happened this morning is just before the Fajr morning prayers, Israeli police closed all the gates leading to the old town of Al-Quds as well as to the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and then allowed only men over the age of 40 to enter the Al-Aqsa Mosque for prayers, while holding their IDs with the Israeli soldiers at the military checkpoints. Following the morning prayers, Israeli soldiers raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex and forced the people, the worshippers, out of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. However, a number of Palestinians were inside the Qibli and the Golden Dome Mosque. They remained in these mosques. However, the Israeli soldiers shut the gates of those two mosques and kept the people inside while allowing Israeli settlers to raid the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. According to the Israeli media, some 728 Israeli settlers under heavy protection from Israeli soldiers raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex and toured in the Muslim holy site while not allowing the Palestinians, the Muslims, to freely pray inside the mosques and the complex as well. Of course, the clashes took place between the Palestinian worshippers and Israeli soldiers, who, of course, attacked the people and brutally they beaten people with their arms and with with the, they also fired heavy tear gas against the Palestinians. At least a dozen of Palestinians were wounded and transferred to hospitals in Al-Quds.
Thank you for that. We appreciate it. Mona Kandil, correspondent there from occupied Ramallah. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Sid Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, joins us from Islamabad. Also joining us, Sami Hamdi, editor-in-chief at the International Interest, who joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Sami Hamdi, I'm going to first start with you. When you take a look at this incident, again, we're looking at violence to have broken out, and you're looking at the way that Palestinians have been injured, 19 of them. Of course, the day before was worse, it was more severe. They say it's because this occasion coincides with Ramadan, when you have Muslims and also Passover and all that, but really the source of the problem is much deeper than that. What are your thoughts on this?
I think it's important, first and foremost, to stress that every Ramadan we see these sort of see this take place. We see a repetition of the Israelis essentially provoking the Palestinians, trying to force them into a confrontation, trying to force them into violence in a bid through which the Israeli or the occupation government, the apartheid regime, can then clamp down and essentially try to use those images to the world to say, look, this is a very unstable situation, and therefore we are the ones who are supposed to task with finding a resolution. The reason being is that what the Israeli government seeks to do, what the apartheid regime in Tel Aviv seeks to do, is to try to make life unbearable for the Palestinians in the Jerusalem area so that the Palestinians will leave. The regime in Tel Aviv, the apartheid regime, has been under significant pressure as a result of the media narrative that is changing as a result of Palestinians and their use of social media. The regime in Tel Aviv wants to make life unbearable for Palestinians in their use of the holy sites, in the use of Al-Aqsa Mosque, in trying to secure basic needs, in going to the market, going to schools, in increasing checkpoints, so that the regime, the apartheid regime in Tel Aviv, can then turn around and say that we did not force them out, they chose to leave by themselves, and this is why we're choosing to demolish the homes in Silwan and Sheikh Jarrah, and this is why we're seizing control of Al-Aqsa. This is all about a long-term strategy that we've seen implemented in other areas. The idea here being that given that the international conscience that is changing as a result of the activism of Palestinians, given that has resulted in the inability of the apartheid regime to use brute force to oust the Palestinians from their land, and given now they are resorting to other tactics in which they are making life unbearable in the hope that these aggressions that they are embarking on against the Palestinians will essentially make the Palestinians leave their territory. And you'll remember former Qatari Prime Minister Hamad bin Jassim, who suggested that there were even some Arab countries that have offered to buy the homes of some of these Palestinians in the Jerusalem area and then handing them over to the Israelis. The idea here being this is about demographic change. This is about trying to bring about demographic change. And this is why we see this on a consistent basis, these umbrella reasons used such as Passover or the like, in a bid to push the Palestinians out of a land that they are dedicated to remaining in come what may.
Sure. Well, say Mohsen Abbas, Israel does have a way of spinning this, and we know that that's what they want the world to say in terms of their spin. From what we understand, they are saying that, you know, this raid, as they call it, they always call it a raid, is an effort to protect the freedom of worship from violent rioters that are desecrating the site and endangering the public, although we know that there are videos that show otherwise of what has happened. Do you think that the world is buying the Israeli narrative, or as our guest Sami Hamdan said there, activist voices are now reaching the masses?
Well, I think there is a world move against Israel, without a doubt. And that's why they are taking increasingly desperate measures. And I think these kinds of actions, especially in the middle of Ramadan, show that desperation, because to attack innocent worshippers at a time which is their most sacred moment in the year, and actually to still try to justify that, clearly is an act of desperation. Clearly, it's not going to win them any brownie points with Muslims around the world, and it's certainly not going to allow them to be able to do the PR spin that they are usually very hell-bent on doing. So I'd say that overall, I mean, they're just falling into the trap that they built for themselves. The special rapporteur on human rights in the occupied Palestinian territories, Michael Lynx, this year, of course, submitted that report to the Human Rights Council, and they concluded very clearly that they are essentially operating an apartheid system, racially motivated oppression against Palestinians, and explicitly designed to maintain Jewish-Israeli domination, as he put it. Well, the Palestinians have known, and their own human rights organizations, they've known for many years that this is the case, and the situation of apartheid is manifested more so by the religious persecution that you see here.
I'm very interested, Sami Hamdi, on the comment that you made about this former Qatari official in terms of buying homes from the Palestinians and handing it over to Israel. Can you tell us about that, or refresh our memory on that, if you can?
The former Qatari Prime Minister and Foreign Minister, Hamad bin Jassim, often considered the architect of the modern Qatari foreign policy that enabled them to expand their influence across the Muslim world and beyond, and also at one point to become the most important lobbying power in Washington. Hamad bin Jassim, in an interview that he gave last year, suggested that there were states that were working with Israel, getting close with Israel, and by in doing so, were embarking on actions such as buying land and or homes from the Palestinians and handing it off to Israelis. According to Hamad bin Jassim, he described that usually when states get close to Israel, it's not usually because they like Israel, it's mainly because they want access to the White House or access to Congress. But he described that in particular one nation, and here the allusion is towards the UAE or the implications of the UAE, although he did not state them specifically, that the UAE have been buying property of the Palestinians, given that the Palestinians are not willing to sell their land to the Israelis. The UAE have gone on the pretext that the Palestinians would be willing to sell their land to a Muslim brother, and then that UAE would later on go on and sell that land later on to the Israeli government as part of this demographic change, part of trying to change the formation of the population within the Jerusalem territories, given that Israel in the past has been able to argue that Palestinians have left their lands in other areas, but the Palestinians in the Jerusalem area specifically, in Sheikh Jarrah, in Silwan, and these others, have been quite problematic for the apartheid regime in Tel Aviv because they refused to leave. They refused to take the offers on the part of the apartheid regime. They refused to bow to the pressure to leave their homes. They refused to sell their land. They continue to go to international public opinion, international courts to try to stop the demolition of their homes. The idea being that Tel Aviv now is trying to use another way to bring about this demographic change by hoodwinking some of those Palestinians into selling land to allies of the Tel Aviv regime and apartheid, by hoodwinking them into selling land to those who are ostensibly coming across as in a brotherly environment,
sure,
and that land slowly making its way to the apartheid regime, which then proceeds to demolish land or the like. But the idea here being is that in this overall theme that we're seeing with what Hamad bin Jassim said, with what we're seeing in Al-Aqsa Mosque, with what we're seeing in terms of the provocations towards the Palestinians, the aim is clear: to oust the Palestinians from that territory, to change it demographically, and to accelerate this change in the demographics quickly, given that the mood, the international mood is changing, given that Amnesty is now using words such as apartheid, given Human Rights Watch is now using words such as apartheid, given the word apartheid is now being used even in the US Congress, given that now we saw Nicholas Kristof who wrote in the New York Times or one of the major American papers that the relationship between the U.S. and Israel is no longer unshakable. The idea here being that the Palestinian activism, as a result of social media that allows them to bypass mainstream media,
right,
has allowed a change in the narrative, and Israel is therefore feels there is an impetus or a need to accelerate the change in demographics before things get much worse.
Sure. Well, that's interesting. So, Mohsen Abbas, so you heard our guest there. What are your thoughts on this? I mean, basically, we're looking at countries, Arab countries, that are going ahead with their normalization with Israel. And perhaps one of the prerequisites, in a sense, or maybe I shouldn't use that word, but one of the conditions is for them to go ahead and buy Palestinian land so they can have a foothold in the White House. Give us your reaction on this.
Well, I think the important point is that everything is that's happened since the so-called normalization process, which United Arab Emirates and Bahrainis and others have been touting, including the Moroccans as well, is that all of that has been proven to be absolutely the wrong direction to take. And quite frankly, the Israeli actions against the Palestinians haven't improved at all. Rather, they've got much worse. And the truth is that the first thing that all of these Arab nations, which have essentially sold out, need to think again. They need to think seriously about reversing those policies, number one, because they haven't produced any of the supposed results which they had said they would with their normalization. So this complicity, first of all, would be something that needs to be erased, and they need to reconvene with their other Arab and neighbors and Iran and the various other nations in that region, and actually have a united stand against Israel, making it quite clear that the only solution for Israel really is for it to return all of the land to the Palestinians, to have free and fair elections for all people, everybody in the diaspora which has a heritage link to Palestine, and to create a state which is based on justice and fairness and equality, not a Jewish fundamentalist state which is hell-bent on using the boot to put under heel the Palestinian people and to muzzle them and to treat them as essentially as animals. That's exactly what they're doing. And so I think that the statements from the foreign minister of Iran, Mr. Khatibzadeh, have been very, very strong on this. And he said very clearly that the violation of human rights, the principles and of international law, which are being shown to be committed as crimes in Al-Aqsa Mosque as we speak almost, are all things which need to be taken seriously both by the international community, but they also demonstrate that the Zionist regime has become too weak to withstand the uprising of the Palestinian people. And this return of the Intifada, if you like, after the Operation Al-Quds Sword, he said, are all indications of how weak Israel is, and the weaker it is, the more desperate it's going to become. But what the more desperate it becomes and the more atrocities it commits, quite clearly, the more the Palestinians themselves are going to be in a rage and will want their freedom, okay, and will fight for it. And that looks like the way it's going to go. And really, I think Israel, the writing seems to be on the wall, both externally and internally, because not only has the Iron Dome and all the myth of Israeli military invincibility been shattered, with their recent escapade, they've also had that myth shattered because they were too weak to even think about invading Gaza militarily. So you can see that their lack of confidence is emanating in their military strategy. Now on the ground, what we're witnessing is this persistent and consistent uprising of Palestinians, which we've seen rising over the last year or so. And of course, we're seeing their desperation in terms of going and attacking worshippers, which is a massive public relations own goal for them. It's really not looking very healthy for the Israelis, and they really need to take stock and realize that I think that the time is up. They need to be really thinking about other ways,
sure,
of dealing with the way they've stolen that land.
Well, so you have these few days here, Sami Hamdi, of the violence that took place at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and of course Israeli forces and the way they conducted themselves against the Palestinians. You have basically the most recent uptick in violence overall in the occupied territories, I'm looking at two more Palestinian youths to have been killed during a raid just 4 days ago in Jenin. Six to have been killed in a matter of 24 hours. Number of Palestinians killed this past week or so now, totaling about 20. You still have about a couple weeks left to Ramadan. I mean, if we are going to go on, continue on this track, or if Israel is going to continue on this track, you're going to have a lot of bloodshed. Why isn't there a reaction coming in terms of the force of concentration by the U.S. and Europeans on Ukraine as to what's going on here in the occupied territories?
I think that's a very good question. I think first and foremost, for Biden, he feels he doesn't need this particular headache. He's focused on Ukraine. He's focused on his allies with Europe. He's focused on why he's unable to get some of his Middle East allies to take his side with regards to this war that's taking place between Russia and Ukraine. He's worried about the negotiations with Iran in terms of establishing a new Iran deal. This matter is way below the pecking order with regards to his particular concerns, especially when he's receiving reassurances on the part of Israeli officials that this is a temporary measure and it will not last especially long. It's also important to put yourself in the position of the regime in Tel Aviv, the idea being that you have Turkey's Erdogan chasing reconciliation, you have Morocco improving its ties with you, UAE improving its ties, Saudi Arabia is signaling increasing normalization of ties. The idea here being that even when you look at Pakistan, the fall of Imran Khan and the likes, you feel like that even in the Muslim world, there is not technically a united front anymore with regards to Palestine that might pressure the Americans into taking a stance in the manner that perhaps they've been able to do in previous times. With regards to Europe, Antonio Guterres, the Secretary General of the UN, issued a statement. He's called on the Israelis to show restraint. That appears to be a more protocol statement, even if perhaps I believe Antonio Guterres often to be a sincere individual in this. But for Europe, Russia is the main problem. This issue is not something that is of particular priority. And this is why the environment is conducive now for the apartheid regime to continue these escalations in a manner that tries to prevent a war from taking place with Hamas or with Gaza, in a way of ensuring that while Ukraine dominates the headlines, this is the time in which to be able to embark on more aggressive measures, given that it won't receive the international attention that it might achieve. But I think more than blaming the US and Europe, I think what's different this time, particularly given that US and Europe in the past have never been really the first to condemn Israel, what's different this time is the stance in the Muslim world. The idea being that the leaders of the Muslim world, or the most of the leaders of the Muslim world, most of the traditional leaders that we've come to expect to release very strong worded statements, to embark on lobbying efforts, to really push to try to restrain Israel or push within their means. We're seeing these traditional leaders rather embark on an approach of trying to reconcile Tel Aviv, or being careful not to upset Tel Aviv, being careful not to ruin their ties or relations with Tel Aviv. And that includes the likes of Erdogan and others. And that is the saddening tragedy of this particular environment in which these events are taking place. I do think, however, that despite this, I do think that Tel Aviv is very keen not to instigate a new war with Gaza. It's well aware that it suffered from its war against Gaza last year. It lost its monopoly over the narrative. It lost its control over the discourse. It suffered as a result of its relations that have now come under question between Tel Aviv and Europe, between Tel Aviv and Washington. Israel doesn't want to get involved in that once more. And the final point that's worth noting is this. Remember that Bennett's government in Tel Aviv is a very precarious composition of multiple parties, whereby if even one withdraws, then his government collapses. And amongst that government are those who are Palestinians. And if they choose to leave the government, his government will come tumbling. He's not in the position Netanyahu used to be beforehand. And this is why I think that while we see these provocations taking place at the moment, if push comes to shove, I do think Bennett is not in a position to provoke an all-out war. But then again, nothing is really surprising when it comes from the apartheid regime.
If we were to follow that narrative of our guest Sami Hamdi, say Mohsen Abbas, why are Arab leaders or the Muslim world's leaders retracting and trying to be cautious about this situation instead of them being on the offensive in terms of condemnation or what have you?
Well, because they're Zionists. They're Arab Zionists. There's no ifs and buts. They can dress themselves up as they like, but all their actions are those of Zionists. All their alliances with Zionist institutions, whether they're Anglo-Zionist or directly Zionist institutions. I think we've come to expect very little from the likes of Erdogan, even Erdogan and the Qataris, who were supposed to be the other supportive element for the Palestinians. Even they've clearly shown a level of hypocrisy which outdoes a lot of what they've been doing in the past. But of course, the likes of Saudi Arabia, who are hypocritically offering their condolences to Palestinians and making sort of statements about how upset they are. The reality is that they've got a total lock-in with Anglo-Zionist imperialist interests, and that's who they operate for. And the minnows, like, of course, the United Arab Emirates or Kuwait and other such folk, again, they are in the same camp. But this is has been a reality of the Middle East for many, many decades, obviously, and it will break, because the reality is that they have a resistance axis of which now Palestine is very much a part. I think that was a little bit touch and go for a fair while, because the Palestinians were often being confused by the likes of Turkey and Qatar and others to say they would come to their rescue. There's been no such thing. The only rescue package for Palestinians on a military level is ultimately going to be, let's face it, from the axis of resistance. And they've shown that results in Yemen, results in Iraq, results in Syria, have achieved victory to the point where at least the Anglo-Zionist imperialists cannot have their own way and are not able to dominate totally. Lebanon is another example. Palestine, I think now, as Ismail Haniyeh, for the Political Bureau of Hamas, said just recently, is now ready to defend Al-Aqsa Mosque at all costs. And this spiritual defense, this religious defense, is something that can resonate across most of the resistance axis, and those Muslims that actually are genuinely not Zionists.
Thank you very much. We're fresh out of time. Thank you for that. Sayed Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator from Islamabad. And we'd like to thank Sami Hamdi, also editor-in-chief of the International Interest from London. And we had our correspondent Monica Ndil from Ramallah at the top of the spotlight. And that does it for this edition of the Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahway and the team, is goodbye until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his immaculate progeny. Dear brothers and sisters all around the world, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to yet another edition from series of Q&A in Islamic beliefs from IRIB English Radio. Dear brothers and sisters, if you have been following this series of shows, we are trying to answer the doubts and misconceptions on the Islamic beliefs, which are received usually in the form of questions from different questioners from around the world. For that, we have again invited a respected scholar, guest of the show, Sheikh Nur Muhammad from Qom Seminary School. Sheikh, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Many thanks for accepting the invitation. It's a great pleasure for us to have you here. The question of the day that we are going to talk about today is about the Holy Quran. We believe that Quran is a revelation by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and no mystic has never ever entered it. So the question I want to ask that if the Holy Quran is a complete book, then why do you try to interpret it? Interpretation or commentary of the Holy Quran is something which actually wants us to know more about what the wordings of the Quran are by the interpreters, the real interpreters of Quran. So it has nothing to do with the comprehensiveness of the Holy Quran, but let's see what the respected Sheikh, that is Sheikh Nur Muhammad, tells us in this regard. That if Quran is a complete book, why do you interpret it? And the second phase of this question again continues to say that, again, he wants to prove, or he or she wants to prove, that Quran is not a complete book. It says, he asks that why some, for example, some verses say something, and in other verses we find something which contradicts with the earlier ones. And it shows, again, another, let's say, aspect of its incomprehensiveness. Would you like you, Sheikh, to shed some light on this question and tell us more about that?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Unfortunately, the day questioner asked this question did not give us any example about the confliction in the verse of the Quran. If he or she could give us some, you know, examples for having some kind of disagreement in the verse of the Quran, of course, we will talk about that issue. But I'm just wondering if we have any verse in the Noble of two verse in the verse of Noble Quran have any kind of disagreement and conflict with each other. It is actually one of the aspect of the miracleness of the Noble Quran. Why Noble Quran is miracle? Because one aspect of that is because there is no disagreement in the verse of Noble Quran. Okay, and the and Quran, you know, ask some kind of challenging with people at tahaddi in the verse of Noble Quran, and Allah Subhanahu wa Taala has kind of challenging and asking people to bring and to find out any disagreement in the verse of Noble Quran.
Very true.
But you cannot. Maybe some people, they lack enough a study about the verse of Noble Quran, they do not have sufficient survey in the verse of Noble Quran, and do not have sufficient and enough studying in the verses of Noble Quran, and they claim to have some kind of disagreement. But if they can give us more examples of that, inshallah, we will give more answers to that. Talking about the first aspect of this question, I would like to ask this question: what is the meaning of tafsir? If you can give me a meaning of tafsir, I withdraw. Yeah. I will, accept your question. I'm sure that dear listeners, maybe the dear question does not have a clear understanding of the meaning of tafsir of the verse of Noble Quran. First of all, there is a difference between interpretation of verse of Noble Quran and the tafsir. Of course, we have to use these terms for the, translation, for lack of the, exact translation of the Islamic terms. We use tafsir, we use interpretation, exegesis, and so on and so forth. But I want to say that interpretation have some differences between tafsir. Let me go to the meaning of tafsir directly and to understand what does it mean.
Yeah.
According to scholars, tafsir means discovering the intended meaning of the verse of Noble Quran.
True.
Ma'ani al-Quran wa madaliliha. And maqasidaha. It has three stages. I do not want to be very technical here because I do not want to cause any confusion.
Thank you.
First of all, to understand very briefly the intended meaning of the verse of Noble Quran, and then what is a final purpose? Maqasid means final purpose of that intended meaning. Okay? This is, and because the verses of Noble Quran are divine, God-given, and the revelation of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, we need to have this kind of discovery, this kind of explanation. this kind of tafsir, because these divine verses are complete and because they are divine. Okay?
Yeah.
I want to say that the reason that why we need